Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's call, Electronic Cigarettes Posing New Challenges for Clinicians. You may view today's presentation in one of two ways, as a webinar or by downloading the slides posted on the New York State Smokers Quit Line website. Links to the slides and webinar are posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit Line website, nysmokefree.com. To access today's presentation, go to nysmokefree.com. On the left-hand side of the website's homepage, there's a newsfeed section. Within this section, there's an announcement for today's call. Click on the link provided, and it will bring you to the page for today's webinar. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Jonathan Folds. Dr. Folds is a professor of public health sciences at Penn State University College of Medicine. On today's call, Dr. Folds will describe the various types and components of electronic cigarettes, current evidence for the clinical use of electronic cigarettes among tobacco users, and how to respond to clinical inquiries regarding e-cigarettes from patients and colleagues. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASIS continuing education credits to today's listeners. To obtain continuing education credits, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms posted on the website. In addition, at the end of the webinar, you can complete the forms online. This is the preferred method for completing the webinar evaluation, and I'll post a link to the online form within the webinar chat box, and it'll also be on the Quitline website after the webinar is completed. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after May 21st. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Folds. Dr. Folds?
Thanks, Anne, and thank you for inviting me to speak to all of you in New York today. I'm actually speaking to you, if you can see the first slide from that building, I'm actually sitting in an office just above the word cancer and on the front of the building from the Penn State Hershey Cancer Institute. So just before we properly get started, I just want to, you know, acknowledge my funding and, you know, potential conflicts of interest. So the main parts I should mention are that I do consulting for pharma companies. I don't do consulting or anything paid for tobacco or electronic cigarette companies. So this next slide, slide three, is just to kind of remind us of the objectives of the webinar today. So it's basically to describe the different types of electronic cigarettes, to go over the current evidence for the clinical use of electronic cigarettes in tobacco users, and then to discuss how we might respond to clinical inquiries regarding e-cigarettes from patients and colleagues. And I think that this latter one is the kind of primary reason why people are probably logging in and interested here, because, you know, people in the field are already getting questions from patients or clients or hospital systems regarding e-cigarettes. How should we manage these? How should we regard them? Should we think of them as smoking cessation devices? Should we think of them as like cigarettes, or if it's somewhere in the middle, where is it? So we're going to try and cover these topics. So I'm going to start off with with tongue in cheek, I'm going to refer to as a visionary statement that I actually made in a paper way back more than 20 years ago. And my thought at that time was that if people have difficulty overcoming both nicotine dependence and long-term habit change, both of these things are hard for people to do, particularly in combination, then surely the solution is to help them avoid most of the health risks with only a minimal alteration in their nicotine-seeking habits. This implies that a nicotine replacement device that looks like a cigarette and delivers cigarette-like boli of nicotine, you know, rapid delivery nicotine, but does not deliver the tar and the carbon monoxide that causes the vast majority of smoking-related diseases, then the development and the promotion of such a product and its eventual replacement of tobacco could have massive beneficial public health implications lasting into the 21st century. So I wrote that more than 20 years ago, and I still believe it to be generally true. But the question that I guess we have to think about just now is whether electronic cigarettes could be that product or not. And saying that 20 years ago, and kind of jokingly saying it's a visionary statement, I'm going to quote my other favourite scientist, apart from myself, Dr. Sheldon Cooper from the Big Bang Theory, who I saw recently saying, "There's a fine line between being visionary and being wrong, and unfortunately you have to be a visionary to see it." So I'm going to talk about e-cigarettes from a particular perspective, and it's the perspective that I just quoted a second ago. That's my perspective. I'm going to try and give you some of the things that I think are facts, but also some, you know, I'll try and say some things that are really just opinion, because there's a lot that's unknown about e-cigarettes. And I'll also try and remember to mention some of the concerns that we all have, that if this doesn't go well, it could go badly. And there are some things that we need to do to try and reduce the risk that the whole e-cigarette story doesn't end badly. So I'm on to the next slide, which is a graph from a very recent paper. And you can actually get the paper online. I think it's freely available. The first author is David Nutt. And this is a paper about the relative harms from nicotine delivery products. And basically, the problem in estimating the harms to health, or all the harms from nicotine delivery products, is that there is not sufficient evidence about this for all of these products to make direct comparisons. We have a lot of evidence about cigarettes, and that's accumulated over decades of research. But for most of the other products, the evidence is less complete. And certainly to compare the risk for the different products, there isn't sufficient data to say it with any precision. So what this paper did was get together a group of so-called experts, met in a room for 2 days, and went through a kind of systematic procedure that I'm not going to describe the details of the procedure, but the aim of it was to come to develop a method to compare the relative risks of all these different products. And it included a whole bunch of different types of harm. And just to kind of give you a clue, the top two colours on these bars, the kind of reddish colour and the green colour, are the two main things that we generally think of when we think of harms from tobacco, which is mortality and morbidity. So those kind of comprise the main kinds of harm that were considered, but this process also considered a whole bunch of other kinds of harm. But the thing I really want to draw your attention to is that on this figure, it lists a number of different tobacco or nicotine products. The one in the bottom right-hand corner, like fourth along, that's called ENDS, that stands for Electronic Nicotine Delivery Systems. That's basically e-cigarettes. There are some other things that come into that category that are not what we think of as e-cigarettes, but it's basically e-cigarettes. And you can see that according to this group's kind of calculations and estimates, which is what they basically are, they came to the conclusion that electronic cigarettes have less than 5% of the net harm that cigarettes do. And even though one might quibble with the precise methods or the precise numbers, I think that's probably about ballpark right, based on what we know now. And that's true for all of these. It's all based on what we know now. And the truth is that for electronic cigarettes, there's a lot more that we don't know than for some of these other products. for most of these other products, we've had decades of use to kind of get a sense of the magnitude of the harms. That's not true for electronic cigarettes. But that's the ballpark that we're looking at right now, kind of probably 5% or less harmful as compared to cigarette smoking. So before I go too much further in talking about electronic cigarettes, I think that perhaps the most important point I think I want to make today is that there is no such thing as an e-cigarette. There are many different kinds of e-cigarettes, and although they have a certain similarity, they are also very different. So I'm going to try and kind of simplify the types by separating them into three different categories. And some other people have done that before. So this is taken from a paper by Farsalanos and Pelosa. So there's the ones that we call first-generation devices. These are the ones on the left that look like a cigarette. They're about the same size as a cigarette. They consist primarily of a battery and then a screw-in cartridge. Some of them are disposables intended for one-time use, for one day, and then you throw it. Some are rechargeable. But their basic characteristics is they're about the same size as a current cigarette. And they've been in the market for a while. And in truth, they're by far the biggest selling category of current electronic cigarettes. Then there's what we call second generation devices. And the picture here is of a typical one. Some of the differences are that it's larger. It has a higher powered battery that holds its charge for a longer period of time. It also, as you can see that picture, it has a button on it. And the purpose of the button is that you can stimulate, with the first generation devices, the heating of the atomizer that turns the liquid into vapor is stimulated by the puff. So it's breath activated. And that means that it doesn't start the heating process until you've got a certain force in your puff. With the second generation devices, the button enables the user to start the heating of the atomizer themselves before the puff. And we believe that that facilitates the ability of the atomizer to get to a sufficient temperature to get the nicotine into the vapor by the time the person takes the puff. So people typically press the button a couple of seconds before they take their puff. And we believe that that's partly why these devices are likely to be more effective in delivering the nicotine and the vapor. Most of the studies of the first generation devices find that they deliver very little nicotine. And I'm going to show you some data on that in a second. And then we've got these, what we refer to as third generation devices. And they come in basically all different shapes and sizes. They're sometimes referred to as mods, partly because they're capable of being adapted or modified by the user. You can switch in the kind of cartridges. You can use a tank where you fill it with liquid yourself, and you can change your design and add things on or take things off. And we believe that the majority of current e-cigarette users are using first-generation devices. And then there's a smaller proportion, but a growing proportion, using these second-generation devices. And then you've got some people using the third-generation devices. And they, I guess they're what we might think of as the geeks who really are into this and don't mind spending a bit of time and becoming like a little mini. It's analogous to people who make their own wine or beer. It becomes almost like a hobby. So moving on to the next slide. This is showing some of the initial data that we got way back in 2010 about the nicotine delivery from products. And this is looking at the first generation products. This is a slide from a study by Van Sickle and colleagues at Tom Eisenberg's lab at Virginia Commonwealth University. If you look at the top part of the slide, it's showing blood nicotine concentration. The bottom part of the slide is showing change in blood pressure, heart rate. And what you can see is that the black squares are the nicotine absorption from smoking a cigarette. And it's just got the typical boost of about 15 to 20 nanograms per mil with each cigarette. underneath that, the diamond shape, and there's also a triangle shape, though you can hardly see it, are people puffing on e-cigarettes at the, you know, at the same pace as the other people were smoking. And you can see that there's very little, almost no increase in blood nicotine concentration. You know, a boost of about 1 or 2 at most nanograms per mil. And down below, you can see that that produces a much smaller change in heart rate. So there is a little bit of nicotine absorption, but really very little. And so little that it's the kind of level of nicotine absorption that we think it's almost imperceptible to a smoker. So these are people who've come to the lab as smokers. They're not e-cigarette users. One day they smoke a cigarette, other days they use other products. And they get almost nothing out of the e-cigarettes. And so, you know, when I saw these data way back in 2010, my impression at that time was that e-cigarettes are really like a neat theatre prop. You know, they look like a cigarette, but they don't act anything like a cigarette because they don't really deliver much nicotine. However, if we come up to much more recent data, this slide was from a study published just this year, just a month or two ago by Farsalanas and colleagues. And what it shows is the blood nicotine levels produced by cigarettes, but also by two different kind of e-cigarettes. So the blue line is showing the blood nicotine absorption. For within the first 5 minutes, the people had to take 10 puffs. That's 2 puffs a minute for 5 minutes. And you can see that the blue line are people using a first-generation device, like a Cigalike. And you can see they did get some nicotine. They got a boost of about 2 or 3 nanograms per mil. Not very much, more like 2.5. And then you can see the brown line are people who used then a more advanced e-cigarette. And sure enough, they did get a higher nicotine absorption. They went from about 2.5 to about 7.5. They got a boost of about just over 4.5 nanograms per mil within 5 minutes. But you can see that compared to the boost from a cigarette, it's still much lower. Both of these are lower. And then after that 10 puffs in 5 minutes, the participants were allowed to continue to puff on their products for another, I think it was actually an hour in the study, and the slide shows the next half hour. And you can see that people, if they keep puffing on them, and this was just what you call ad lib, which was just as you feel like it, they kept puffing on the products. And you can see that they are capable of getting what we might consider to be therapeutic levels, you know. But the absorption is quite slow. It's a bit more like nicotine gum as opposed to a cigarette itself. So there is sufficient nicotine here to reduce nicotine withdrawal symptoms and craving, but the speed of absorption is nothing like a cigarette. These people are probably having to work fairly hard even to get that lower level of nicotine absorption. So we think that both the level of nicotine absorbed and the speed of absorption are what, you know, are the characteristics that people, smokers are smoking for. They want a relief of nicotine withdrawal, and B, a kind of reinforcing effect. And it's not clear that, certainly not the Cigalike or the first generation devices, are providing sufficiently fast nicotine absorption, probably not even an amount of nicotine that really is very good at providing any kind of satisfaction that could compete with a cigarette. But you can see that if they work at it, they may get some enough nicotine that could reduce craving or nicotine withdrawal. And the more advanced devices giving faster nicotine, probably a bit more efficient at that, but still not seeming to compare. But in the next slide, I'm showing you some data that was from a poster presented at SRNT 2014, just this year, by Spindle, Breland, and Eisenberg. Again, a study from Eisenberg's lab at Virginia Commonwealth University. And this is interesting because you can see this is on a different scale, but you can see that within 5 minutes, these five people using a particular kind of e-cigarette are getting a boost in their blood nicotine levels of about 12, maybe a little bit more than that, nanograms per mil in 5 minutes. Now, that's more like a cigarette. You can get higher levels from a cigarette than that, but it's in the same ballpark. And so what this what to me this is very interesting because it shows the proof of principle that some e-cigarettes can produce a nicotine delivery that's almost like a cigarette. It's fast and it's a boost of over 10 nanograms per mil, which is what we generally regard as the level you need to get to within a short space of time to produce a really reinforcing effect, which is like the opposite of we think of the nicotine patch, which can get that level of nicotine, but it takes 3 or 4 hours to get there. And so there's you don't find people get satisfaction or addiction from a nicotine patch, but they do get craving and withdrawal relief compared to a day without it. But it doesn't really compare. If you ask people, what do you feel most satisfaction from, a cigarette or a patch, then it's a no-brainer. And for some people to be able to quit smoking, we think that some people probably will have a greater chance if they can use a product that delivers the nicotine like a cigarette. And this shows that that's at least theoretically feasible. Some people are using products that can do that. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and look at some population data from England, because in England they're tracking this fairly closely. They have a big survey that occurs, on an ongoing basis. Every quarter they recruit thousands of people to the survey, and it's a representative sample. So you can see here that I suspect that the patterns are somewhat similar in the United States, but we aren't tracking it in quite this way, at least not in a way that you can access publicly. So if you want to follow how it goes in England, if you go onto that website, this is updated every quarter, so you can look at the latest stuff. But you can see that up to about 2012, there was a slow growth in e-cigarette use. But as of 2014, the first quarter, we had about 15% of smokers had tried e-cigarettes, and about half of those people were daily users. So quite a growing and quite high rate of trial of product, and also a growing and quite high rate of continuing to use on a regular basis. Slightly less than half of the people who tried it were using it, which is interesting in itself, because that's different from what we get with most NRT products. Now, if we looked at aids to use in a quit attempt in England over the same time period, you can see that up until about 2012, it was very clear that by far the most commonly used smoking cessation products were over-the-counter nicotine replacement products. That's that kind of brownie line at the top there. About a third of people who used an aid were using those products. But you can see that the green line is e-cigarettes, and it was low but rising very slowly up to about the end of 2012, and then it increased sharply throughout 2013 and kind of plateaued. But by the first quarter of 2014, e-cigarettes had become the single most frequently used product to help with smoking cessation. You can see that there are other products listed here, or other methods. The red line is Chantix, that's prescription NRT, and the blue line is behavioural support, and the kind of brownie line is Chantix. So I guess the striking point here is the rapid rise of e-cigarettes to become the most commonly used smoking cessation aid in England in about the last year and a half. So then the question is, has this seemed to have any relationship with success rates? So one thing I'd like to draw your attention to, if we go to the next figure, so this is a figure with a kind of purple line over time. You can see that each year we're talking of about surveys of about a couple of thousand smokers. And if we look at the very latest data point, it's always a smaller number because it's only for one quarter of the year. But what it looks like is that the percentage of those who tried to quit, who succeeded in quitting, was kind of flat, around 13-14% up until 2011. Since 2011, it has increased and it reached its highest point in the first quarter of 2014, it seems like. Now, this is the same time frame when people were increasing the use of e-cigarettes. We don't know that that's a direct cause and effect, but it certainly doesn't seem to suggest that e-cigarettes are reducing quitting to any extent. And if we then look at smoking prevalence in England, which was coming down fairly slowly from 2008, 9, 10, 11, you know, about 0.5% or thereabouts every year. We can see that from 2012 to 2014, it seems to be continuing to decline. So again, no evidence that this increase in e-cigarette use is somehow being coinciding with an increase in smoking. In fact, quite the opposite. So the conclusions from that data in England are that the increase in e-cigarette prevalence continues, but it may have slowed. If you notice that in that figure, it kind of seemed to flatten out in just the last year. The growth in electronic cigarette use has been accompanied by a reduction, albeit a smaller reduction, in the use of licensed smoking cessation products like nicotine replacement or prescription medicines, but it doesn't seem to have had much impact on the use of behavioural support. And the evidence doesn't seem to support the view that e-cigarettes are undermining motivation to quit or reducing smoking or undermining the reduction in smoking prevalence that's taking place over time. And the use of e-cigarettes by never smokers remains extremely rare in England. You know, less than 2% of people who are using e-cigarettes are never smokers. And the evidence also conflicts with the view that electronic cigarettes are undermining tobacco control or renormalising smoking, and they may even be contributing to a reduction in smoking prevalence through increased success in quitting smoking. And just to be clear, we can't be sure what's cause and effect here, but there's not any clear signs that the increase in use of e-cigarettes is coinciding with any obvious worsening of smoking rates or reduction in quitting rates. Now, some countries have already, if we go on to the next conclusion slide, some countries have already banned e-cigarettes. Quite a lot of countries, actually. Brazil, Australia. In Australia, they've just banned the liquid. So the device isn't banned, but the liquid containing nicotine is banned. So that's an effective ban. And in actual fact, the number of countries that have banned e-cigarettes is increasing fairly regularly. So I guess my question is banning the appropriate response to electronic cigarettes in any country where we're allowing highly toxic cigarettes to dominate the nicotine market? I don't think so. But I think we all agree that electronic cigarettes should be regulated, for example, so that they can't be sold to under 18s, that they should have adequate safety standards. For example, they should be childproof, and particularly the liquid part should be in a childproof container, and there should be quality controls. So we want them to be, you know, as low risk as possible. So, for example, the liquid that goes into the e-cigarette should have no toxicants in the liquid, certainly nothing that's not essential to their function. An e-cigarette should not be used in indoor public places covered by clean indoor air legislation. Now, that, as I'm sure you all know, that's one of the things that's most controversial, and it's not, that topic isn't really what I've been asked to speak about, but it does come up fairly regularly, and it certainly comes up in the advertising for the products. For many of the companies, they advertise the product as, you know, something you can use in places where smoking's banned. Just so you know, my opinion on this is that although it's absolutely clear that the vapor that's emitted from electronic cigarettes is much less harmful in the sense that it has much lower concentrations of toxins than cigarette smoke, and you know that's part of the basis for why we think for the user that's a big step in the right direction, because you're reducing your toxin exposure if you can completely switch from cigarettes to e-cigarettes. I don't feel that's the right comparison for public air. So for public air, where you've got lots of people who are not users of tobacco at all, then the right comparison is clean air. And so I don't think that just because the vapor produced by e-cigarettes is much less toxic than cigarette smoke, that therefore that should be the norm. The norm should be clean air rather than less toxic than cigarette smoke air. So my feeling is that it's a mistake for e-cigarette manufacturers to imply that these should be fine to use in public places, and that by and large, e-cigarettes should not be used in workplaces just in the same way that we don't allow smoking. And I'm not saying that because I believe that they're as harmful, because it's fairly clear that they're not. You know, that passive environmental vapor is not as harmful as cigarette smoke. But that, I just don't think that's the point. You know, I think it's almost analogous to, if somebody came into anywhere, it could be a library, it could be a bar, it could be your hospital, with a stereo system blaring at 85 decibels because they like the music. Now, it may not be loud enough to harm anybody's eardrums, but I think we'd all agree that we don't want to have to work in an environment where people come and just play their music really loud. It's unpleasant, inconvenient. It impairs our quality of life. And we have every right to say no, take it outside. And I think the same goes for e-cigarettes. No, and I think there is a slightly more serious point that there may well, even though the, on average the vapor that the e-cigarette is producing may not be as harmful as cigarette smoke, in fact it's almost certainly not, that doesn't rule out the possibility that some people may be sensitive to that. So there may be some people with asthma or maybe some other conditions, respiratory illnesses, that are sensitive to nicotine in the air or the vapor in the air that could trigger an asthma attack. And nobody should have to breathe air that way. So that's my opinion. So I guess e-cigarettes can, in my opinion, they can do the most good not in the clinician's office. As clinicians, we always think of, I'm thinking, how does this affect my work? And should I be for this product? Should I advocate it? Should I prescribe it? Should I tell people to use it? And right now, I don't think really any clinician should be telling people to use e-cigarettes at all. But that's a separate thing from thinking that they may still do some good. And I think the main place that they'll do good is not in the clinician's office, but rather by competing effectively in the nicotine marketplace against much more harmful smoked tobacco products, primarily cigarettes. You know, about 90% to 98% of the tobacco or nicotine market is cigarettes, pretty much the most harmful form of taking nicotine. E-cigarettes have the potential to compete with cigarettes in a way that none of the other products that we have been able to do. And if in the marketplace they can get people to switch, and who knows, as I said right at the beginning, potentially replace cigarettes as the dominant nicotine delivery device, then I think that's the way that they could do some good. So I was asked to kind of discuss some real clinical scenarios, some things that might come up in our clinical practice, and then discuss how I think that it might be handled. So here's the first case. So this is somebody who says, I'm a heavy smoker, and both my parents were smokers who died of lung cancer. I've tried all the meds, but never quit for more than a week. And I've heard that e-cigarettes can help smokers to quit, and I really want to give it a shot. What can you tell me about them? So the question is, what might we say to somebody who comes and says that to us? So my feeling is that the very first principle is that if you've got a smoker who's interested in quitting, then we should support the quit attempt. That's the first thing. We should be positive and encourage them however they want to do it. But I would say that we should continue to assess and treat this person just as they would any other smoker. So for me, the two main things you want to assess in a tobacco user are, number one, their motivation to change, and this person is expressing a wish to change, which is a good thing, and number two, their level of dependence. Because if they smoke a couple of cigarettes a week, they're probably not particularly addicted at all, and so the question of medication or adjuncts really doesn't arise, in my opinion. If they're a two-pack-a-day smoker who smokes their first cigarette within 2 minutes of waking in the morning, that's a whole different kettle of fish. The chances of that person succeeding with a bit of brief advice are unfortunately, really, they're very slim. So this person, it sounds like they're motivated, but they're also quite highly addicted. It sounds like they've tried quite a few times before. So we've got a sense of that. And I would think it's always a good idea to discuss a little bit about their prior quit attempts and to make sure they fully understand all their treatment and support options. So many people say, I've tried everything, but when you ask them for a little bit more detail on what they've tried, many smokers haven't actually tried everything. And you know, nowadays we know that some things are more effective than others. We know that for a heavy smoker, that combining the patch with another nicotine replacement product is more effective than just the patch on its own, for example, or any individual NRT. There's pretty good evidence now that Chantix is more effective than any of the individual NRTs, but combination NRT can get as good results as Chantix. So the question would be, what have you tried? And have you tried combining NRTs? Have you tried Chantix? And if there are aspects to treatment that in fact they haven't tried, then my first inclination would be to inform them that there are things that they haven't tried yet and that they work, and they may work better than the things that they've tried already. That includes informing them about behavioral support. Did they know there's a free telephone quit line in their state? Did they know that there's some really good websites out there that they could use? Did they know that if you call the quit line, you maybe have access to reduced cost or free nicotine replacement, for example? So to make sure that they know that there are evidence-based treatments that are accessible, that they don't have to pay a lot of money for. If the person says, yeah, I know all that, I've tried all that, but I really want to try an electronic cigarette, then I think we have to inform them what we know and what we don't know about electronic cigarettes. And then whichever way they decide to go, assist them in developing a plan to quit smoking and arranging a follow-up. Basically the 5 A's like we would normally do. So let's talk about the detail. So NRT monotherapy, if that's all they've tried, then combination NRT, even reduced to quit, if that's what they feel they want to do, which means that you're using NRT to help you reduce towards quitting. And then you've got your prescription bupropion or varenicline options. Make sure they know that these are options. You've got the New York State quit line. Tell them about that. Tell them what it offers, nysmokefree.com, what that website offers. I generally recommend people try smokefree.gov and become an x.org, because I think they're both pretty good websites as well. And they have some other interesting options, ask an expert things, or you can sign up for a texting system to help you quit smoking as well from smokefree.gov. Then inform what we know and we don't know about e-cigarettes. And that's partly what I've said before, and we can talk a little bit more about the other information that's worth sharing. So there's many types of e-cigarettes. They're currently unregulated. So they don't deliver smoke, so it's not smoking, but they've not been proven to be safe and effective like the medicines have. They don't come with any clear instructions for use. So how you're supposed to use it and what dose you're supposed to use, you kind of have to guess it because there's no instructions with the products. The truth is that the clinical trials to date have had disappointing results. But unfortunately, all the clinical trials to date have exclusively used what we might call first-generation models, ones that look like a cigarette and deliver almost no nicotine. So it's not really a big surprise that the trials to date have not had very good results, because they've all used e-cigarettes that are almost like placebos, that they deliver a tiny amount of nicotine. So I don't think we yet have seen a well-designed randomized controlled trial of e-cigarettes using an e-cigarette that actually delivers a meaningful amount of nicotine. So hopefully we will see these soon, and then we'll get a better idea. I mean, we could inform people that the one really good trial by Bullen and colleagues published in The Lancet did find that there was a similar quit rate between the e-cigarette and the patch. But the truth is that trial, the quit rate in the patch group was remarkably low. I mean, sometimes we do find low quit rate from the patch, but that one was lower than average. And the other thing about that trial, that even though it's the best one we have so far, it was not ideal, partly because for the people in the trial who were randomized to the e-cigarette, they were given it directly, whereas the people who are randomized to the patch, they weren't given the patches directly. They were given a voucher that they then had to take to the pharmacy to get the patch. And although that's a small step, and it was done in New Zealand, and it was designed to mimic the way the system for getting patches works in New Zealand, it did mean there was an additional step, and we don't normally do that in clinical trials where we're doing head-to-head. We like to compare them where you give both the products in the same way. And that may have accounted for the unusually poor quit rates with the patch. But ultimately, we don't have any evidence, in all truth, to suggest that e-cigarettes are more effective than the medicines that we have at our disposable right now. And in fact, we know that those medicines are not particularly risky, and we really don't know much about the long-term health effects of electronic cigarettes. So it's worth telling people what's in the liquid. So I'm on to the next slide, headed liquid, that has a picture of some of the bottles that the liquids typically come in. So the liquid that's put into e-cigarettes typically contains propylene glycol, and it's often or usually mixed with glycerol or vegetable glycerin, very similar product. Now, both of these products are generally regarded as safe by FDA when consumed orally like a food. To be honest, there's not really good data on their safety for inhalation over a long period of time. The other product that's usually in e-cigarette liquid is nicotine, of course, and that comes in a range of doses. You can choose a level of zero. You can have no nicotine, all the way up to the highest that's usually sold is 36 milligrams per mil. It's worth pointing out that very often the bottles that are used for refilling tank systems or dripping, the concentration in the labeling is very poor. Very often it doesn't tell you in the bottle how many mils are in the bottle. It doesn't tell you precisely the milligrams per mil. And this becomes a problem not so much for the user, but if somebody, like a child, got their hand in the bottle and maybe put some of it in their mouth, it becomes very hard to tell anybody how much they consume because it's not clearly labelled. The other characteristics of the e-liquid is that it comes in all kinds of different flavours. I mean, I've listed some here: tobacco flavour, menthol flavour, mint flavour, fruit flavour, menth, you name it. But the truth is that there are hundreds of flavours, cookies and cream, you name it, you can get e-cigarette juice that flavour. And there are sometimes, the flavours themselves imply additives because each flavour requires a different substance to give it the flavour. So there are also some concerns about, not just about the flavours themselves, but what are the things that are used to give the flavour and what are the effects of long-term inhalation. As I'm sure you all know, one of the biggest concerns about the flavours is whether these are, that's part of the thing that really attracts young people to them. Strawberry flavour, cookies and cream flavour, candy flavour. Is this a thing that makes e-cigarettes particularly attractive to young people? And that's definitely a concern. My feeling is that we should do what's necessary to prevent young people getting their hands on e-cigarettes and on liquids. That's clear. But I'm not 100% sure that the knee-jerk reaction should be to ban all the flavours. For example, one reason could be that the flavours, we've done a bunch of surveys of e-cigarette users, and it's clear that they really value the flavours. They find one that they prefer, and they tend to then stick to it. They may change from time to time, but they like the fact that they have a positive flavour. And it's possible that may, in the long run, have a relapse prevention effect. So if you've been a Marlboro smoker for years and years, and you get to like that, and you don't particularly like to smoke your friend's menthols, you like your flavour, it's become associated with nicotine for you. And then you quit smoking and you switch to e-cigarettes, let's just say they're cookies and cream flavour in the juice, you then associate that with your nicotine dose. And so, after maybe 3 months or whatever, you've come to like that flavour, that e-cigarette. If you slip and have a cigarette at a party that has the old tobacco flavour, it may be that because it's so different from what you've come to like, you may be less likely to relapse. Now, that's a theoretical question. I'm not saying there's any evidence for it. I guess what I'm trying to point out that although it might seem obvious that we should do what we can to make these things less appealing to kids, we have to be careful we don't kick the baby out with the bathwater and make them less appealing to adults versus cigarettes, because really the idea is to make cigarettes as less appealing as possible. So let's move on and talk about another clinical scenario. In fact, this is still the same one. So this is what my kind of model answer would be. So the evidence from clinical trials suggests that the best quit rates are achieved by maximizing your psychosocial support. That's group face-to-face support plus the quit line plus online. You know, all those three things would be great. Pharmacological support as well. So combination NRT, Chantix, for as long as it takes. And if you choose to use these treatments, they'll likely increase your chances of quitting by 2 to 4 times. So if that person hadn't tried that, I'd encourage them to use that. An e-cigarette may help, but we don't yet have very solid data on how helpful they are or what the longer-term health risks might be. And if you choose one that provides you with a decent amount of nicotine, it's likely it will help you in much the same way that NRT helps, because it delivers nicotine also. And as the e-cigarette delivers nicotine plus a few more chemicals, it is very likely to be less harmful than smoking. So, that's that case. I just want to touch on another thing that's hit the news quite a bit recently, which is reports about poisons, young people, mainly kids, young kids being poisoned by e-cigarettes. So there was a report published by CDC a couple of months ago about that. And the headline was that, you know, thousands of children are being poisoned by e-cigarette exposure. And so this figure that you can see shows the actual data from the study. And the bottom blue line shows the increase in telephone calls to poison centres around the country over time. And it's very clear there has been an increase, which is not that surprising because there's been a marked increase in use over time. But the other thing I'd like to point out is that for every single one of the months in this study, and I think it was 41 months, for every single one of those 41 months, the number of children who were reported to the poison centres as being poisoned by cigarettes was much more. You know, usually like 3 or 4 times as many. And so I think I'm just pointing that out so that we keep some of this in perspective. That, you know, this has been going on, kids getting access to cigarettes, I mean like 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds or even less, crawling about on the floor, finding their parents' packet of cigarettes, putting a few of them in their mouth, and the parents, you know, being concerned quite reasonably and calling the poison centre. That's been going on for decades. So why do we suddenly have a call for action and freaking out about it when there's an increase in the new product? I would say that the first thing we should do is to require that regular cigarettes are only sold in child-proof containers. If we want to protect children, that's the first thing we should do, because that's the thing that's causing by far the most harm, both to the active users and to kids who find them when they crawl about on the floor and get a cigarette in their mouth. That's not to say that we shouldn't make sure that e-cigarettes are as child-proof as possible also. But I think we should be careful that we don't focus all our attention on the shiny new products and just let the traditional ones that do all the harm have a free pass. So let's move on to the next scenario. So this is a 52-year-old woman, smokes a pack a day, more than 7 quit attempts in the past 10 years, some success with meds and counselling. She's returning for an annual follow-up, and this time she's 9 months tobacco-free. She's never been able to quit for more than 6 months before. She's got a low CO, her lung function improved, and initially she started on a Cigalike, but she's moved on to a fancier one. And she completed what we use, this Penn State Electronic Cigarette Dependence Index, and she's quite addicted to her electronic cigarette, but she feels that it's helping her to stay off cigarettes, and she's got no plans to quit, but she asks about the long-term effects. So these slides here just kind of show some of the questions that we use to assess dependence on electronic cigarettes. I don't want to go too much over time, so I'm not going to go through it in great detail right now. But they're adapted from questions that, that measure cigarette dependence quite accurately. This slide here, the bar graph, basically shows that in a study we've done with over 4,000 e-cigarette users, and we asked them to compare their level of dependence in these questions with cigarette smoking, because they were all ex-cigarette smokers, they're very clear that people rated themselves as being less addicted to their e-cigarettes than they were to their cigarettes. And in that same study, when we compare the concentration of nicotine in this next slide with their score in the dependence questionnaire, as you would expect, they had a lower score if they were using zero nicotine liquid compared to higher concentrations of e-liquid. So the questionnaire does seem to relate in what seems like a sensible and meaningful way to dependence with the amount of nicotine they're absorbing. So I would say that to this person, there are probably long-term health effects of inhaling nicotine, propylene glycol, vital glycerin, flavings, and unknown additives, you know, in the future, but the health effects are unknown. It's very likely worse for health than inhaling fresh air. That seems likely. But it's very likely much less harmful to health than smoking cigarettes. So the most important thing for this patient is to stay off cigarettes in the immediate future. So I'd encourage her to start thinking about weaning herself off e-cigs, possibly by reducing the nicotine concentration in her liquid, but only if she feels secure and not relapsing back to smoking. So, conclusions. The Food and Drug Administration recently announced its intent to regulate e-cigarettes. I think we all need to be clear that that's going to take a while, and I actually think it's appropriate for, states, for example, to go ahead with their own regulations rather than just wait for the FDA. It may take years for the FDA to really get it sorted out. E-cigarettes are very likely much less harmful to health than smoking, but we should remember individual issues like pregnancy. You really don't want a pregnant woman to be using anything that contains a drug, and that includes e-cigarettes. And so we should be kind of careful about giving any impression. For example, it's a common misconception that these just contain water vapor. Well, that's not true. They contain more than water vapor. So we should discourage all non-tobacco users from initiating e-cigarette use. We should encourage all dual users to switch completely to e-cigarettes. And we should preserve the right to breathe clean air in the workplace. However, we should be honest with the public about what we know and what we don't know about e-cigarettes without demonizing them. Our focus should be in reducing the use of smoke products. And I'll just leave you with this figure that kind of gives a ballpark estimate of the relative risk of these products. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Folds, for your excellent and very informative presentation. This is Pat Bax. I'm the marketing coordinator with the New York State Smokers Quitline. And on behalf of the New York State Smokers Quitline, welcome to all our participants who are joining us for our call today. Thanks to those of you who are familiar with and utilize our services, and if you're new to the Quitline, we are a free, confidential, and evidence-based cessation service. We're based at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, and we provide cessation help and resources for everyone across the state. And a tobacco user can call us directly. They can register for nicotine replacement therapy online, or they can be referred by their provider. We do offer free coaching, nicotine replacement patches, motivational support, and a wide range of resources, as most of you have seen on our website. We do have a free online community and our messaging service, including text messaging. Our provider referral program does include our OptiQuit program for hospitals and healthcare facilities, as well as downloadable materials that you can find under the Health Provider and Partner section at nysmokefree.com. In relation to our topic today, in August of 2013, we added additional screening questions on the use of e-cigarettes by our participants. And to provide you with a perspective, since adding these questions, of the 465 participants who did respond to the question about e-cigarette use from August to December 2013, 67% used e-cigarettes as a way to help them quit regular cigarettes, and 44% used them to help cut down on regular cigarettes. So far in 2014, slightly more than 5% of our participants do report e-cigarette use. And our QUIT coaches are trained on messaging for tobacco users who have questions about e-cigarettes, and we also have a fact sheet on e-cigarettes that you can download for free at nysmokefree.com under Resources, Guides, and Materials. If you have questions or you want more details, you can call us directly at 1-866-697-8487. And also please keep in mind our QUIT line services and resources when you're planning cessation activities related to quitting smoking for World No Tobacco Day and on July 4th. So thank you for participating on our call today, for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients to become and stay tobacco-free. And at this time, I'm going to return the call back to Dan. We are going to be opening it up for questions. And due to time, we do have a number of questions coming in through our chat that we will be answering and posting our responses at our QUIT site. So thank you again. And, Dan, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Okay. The floor is now open for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, the floor is now open for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. We do have a question on the line from Joan Corasanti. Joan, please state your question.
Hi. I was just wondering, how do you judge your dose of nicotine replacement, patch gum lozenge, when the person's also using an e-cigarette and with a questionable amount of nicotine in the e-cigarette?
Well, that's a good question, and the honest answer is I don't know. But I guess to simplify things, I would probably basically make an assumption that the nicotine replacement we're talking about is the primary source of nicotine. So I would basically encourage them to use the level of nicotine replacement that we would normally use if they were just smoking, okay? Mm-hmm. And say to them, my advice is that you stick to the medicine, you know? And just to add a little bit of context, I'm a psychologist. I'm not an MD. I'm not a nurse practitioner or a prescriber. So my style when speaking to smokers is not to say, I recommend X. I'm not qualified to recommend anything. I basically say, here's what the evidence suggests, here's how the products work, which ones would you choose? And if they choose an over-the-counter product, we help them to get access to it. If they say they would like to try a prescription product, then I work with a nurse practitioner, for example, who would be the person who would see them to check that they're happy with writing the prescription. But I would think the way to handle this would be to treat it as if they're not using e-cigarettes, because we really don't know what's in these cigarettes, to encourage them to stick with the safe and effective pharmaceutical products. And if they want to add the e-cigarette on top of that, then that's fine. I, generally speaking, in clinical practice, I have almost no concerns about somebody taking too much nicotine, you know, a smoker getting too much nicotine from some other replacement device, because generally there's nothing as efficient at delivering nicotine as a cigarette. And the number of cases that I've seen where they get too much nicotine from other devices is negligible. The biggest problem is not getting enough nicotine replaced when you're trying to quit smoking.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. We do have a question on the line from Joan O'Connor. Joan, please state your question.
Hello, thank you. I'm just wondering if you have any comments about the increasing involvement of big tobacco in the e-cigarette market.
Yes, I do. Unfortunately, this we should be clear that most of the e-cigarettes, many of these cigarettes sold are not owned or sold by tobacco companies, but many of them are. For example, Blue is owned by Lorillard, which sells Newport, and there's an increased move towards selling e-cigarettes by big tobacco companies. And obviously that's a concern, because they, unfortunately, they have the resources to completely take over this market. And one of the unfortunate, I think we need regulation, but one of the unfortunate consequences of regulation is that regulation means it's more expensive to be in the market. You can't do it as a mom-and-pop shop anymore, because to meet the regulatory requirements requires investment. It requires you to have money. And unfortunately, I believe that over the next few years, we're going to see tobacco companies, e-cigarettes, start to dominate. And I think that is a concern. I think they have a conflict of interest as to whether they really want people to switch. The only way this can be for good is if the big cigarette manufacturers observe that they're starting to make more and more profit from e-cigarettes, and it's reducing their dependence on cigarettes. In that case, they might gradually morph into e-cigarette companies. Now, some people might say, "Who are you kidding?" And there are other things we can do to encourage that process. If we increase the taxes and we ban menthol and we, reduce advertising and all those good tobacco control things that we're familiar with, mass media campaigns against cigarettes, then and we have a less harsh regulation of e-cigarettes, that's the way the market may go.
Thank you.
Again, if you do have a question or would like to make a comment, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. We do have another question from Donna Lennon. Donna, please state your question.
Hello. Is there any thoughts on requiring a prescription for the additives, for the solutions for the e-cigarettes, so that a physician can then control, or a healthcare work professional can control, the amount of nicotine that someone is receiving? So maybe the ones that do not contain nicotine, there's nothing required, but is there something so that you can titrate or wean a patient off?
Well, I guess the short answer would be for me that to require a doctor's prescription for your e-cigarette liquid would be disastrous. It would end e-cigarettes as we currently know it. It would completely end their opportunity to compete with tobacco, and it would be to guarantee the continued dominance of cigarettes as the primary source of nicotine. I mean, there's a whole other bunch of things I could say why that's a bad idea. Number one, doctors don't know anything about e-cigarettes, so how would they be able to prescribe them?
That's teaching.
Right, well, e-cigarettes are changing all the time. Sorry?
Medicine's changing all the time too. So,
right. You asked the question. So my opinion is that would not be a good idea.
Okay. Thank you.
We do have another question on the line from Cole Parks. Cole, please state your question.
The question is, are there any studies that give information about nicotine gum in addition to long-term use addiction to that, to the gum?
About addiction to gum, yeah, there are lots of studies. So it's very clear that a significant but small proportion of people who try nicotine gum become dependent on it and become long-term users. Typically, we define that as using beyond the initial three-month period, and certainly somebody that uses gum for more than a year, we kind of say that, given that the labeling says 3 months, if you're still using it 6 or 12 months. It's hard to give an estimate of the percentage, but in trials it's maybe around 4 or 5%, 7%. You have people who start using gum and are encouraged and given it for free end up using it for longer than the 3 months. And generally speaking, if you look at the baseline characteristics of the people who become long-term gum users, nicotine gum, they match the characteristics of people who in the placebo arm of the trial did not succeed in quitting smoking. They tend to be the more addicted smokers who become the long-term users. And so generally speaking, from that learning, I don't get concerned about long-term gum use. If the person's not concerned, if they say, "I've been using gum for a year or 2 years or 3 years, but I'm not smoking, and I think this is helping me to stay off cigarettes," I say, "Good, I think you're doing the right thing."
Now, there's no documented long-term health effects. We have folks in our room that know people that have been chewing gum for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the best evidence we have on the first of all, one case that you have to always mention is pregnancy. So there's no doubt that nicotine absorption in pregnancy is bad for the fetus. So that's a clear thing. So if somebody age 22 starts using nicotine gum and quits smoking, that's good. But if that woman decides she wants to have kids, then I would be advising her to get off the nicotine before she gets pregnant. But in the general scheme of things, people quitting in middle age and kids are not part of the story. We have evidence from countries like Sweden that there's probably a very small but a real slight increase in cardiovascular risk from long-term nicotine use. Whereas cigarettes will double or triple your chances of a heart attack, long-term smokeless tobacco use will increase it by about 5 or 10%, probably. And so, like any unnecessary drug, we'd say to people, you'd be better off, you know, weaning yourself off it. But unlike most drugs, the people who switch from cigarettes to nicotine gum or smokeless tobacco, for that matter, they've usually done that because they were addicted to the drug anyway in a much more toxic form. So just as we said with e-cigarettes, it's really if the person feels that the product they're taking with nicotine is helping them from going back to cigarettes and that they would be at greater risk of relapse if they stop using it, then in that case, I wouldn't feel there's a great rush. If the person's trying to have kids or themselves feels they really want to get off the product, then we help them. And you know, for gum, it might be substituting patch plus confectionery sugar-free gum, or forget the patch and just switch to chewing gum and support just like we'd give to a smoker.
Thank you.
Okay, it's 10 after 1, so to be respectful of everybody's time, I've posted in the chat box, if you do have additional questions, please post them in the chat box. You can send them to everyone. You can send them to Pat Bax or to me, whichever is your preference. And we will forward them to Dr. Folds to respond to, and then Pat Bax will post those on the Quitline website at the link that we have provided within the chat box. This concludes our webinar series, actually, until this fall. So enjoy your summer and check the Quitline website for the next webinar announcement that should be coming in September or October of 2014. On behalf of the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control, the Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today. And thank you all for participating in today's call. This will bring us to an end. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. You may disconnect your line at this time.